This is episode number 308 with Henrik Wölderlin of the Founder Podcast.
What you need is thirst. You need to be a thirsty human
who is intent on learning.
It's a really fascinating exploration of human potential.
Now. The Founder Podcast. Even the greatest entrepreneurs had help. If you want to learn from the most successful founders on the planet, you are in the right place. Branson, Mark Cuban, Tony Robbins, Tim Ferriss, Arianna Huffington, Seth Godin, Steve Case, Gary Vee, Sophia Amorosa, Robert Corcoran, Damon John. Learn from the greatest minds in business today with interviews hosted by Nathan Chan. This is not your average entrepreneur podcast. The Founder Podcast.
Hey guys, thank you so much for tuning in. Before we start today's episode, I just want to let you know that our goal at Founder is to help entrepreneurs succeed however we can by giving away high quality content in the form of interviews, blog posts, podcasts, YouTube videos, you name it. We put out so much content to help you. And another interesting project that we're working on right now is partnering with world-class founders like Damon John, Alexa Von Tobel, Greta Van Riel, and so many more to teach crucial skills like negotiation, finance, e-commerce, and so much more. So if you'd like to get access to these free trainings with founders like this, which is 100% free, just go to founder.com/free. Okay, so now let's talk about today's episode. What's going on, Founder fam? Hope you are doing okay during these crazy times. My name is Nathan Chan, CEO and publisher of Founder Magazine, and I am the host of this podcast. So let's talk about today's guest, Henrik Wölderlin. He is the co-founder of a very large company called Bark. Now, that is their parent company. You may be familiar with BarkBox, which was one of their first products in the pet industry. And now they're really starting to branch out. So this was an incredible interview. If you're looking to create a subscription company, a physical product business, scale up a physical product business, and also, you know, understand how a physical product company during a crazy time like this is handling leadership decisions, strategic growth decisions, product decisions, and all these kinds of things. I really kind of had a fantastic conversation with Henrik. And we also talked about his latest book, The Acorn Method, where he talks about how they're scaling their company and how they move into different verticals, how they test products. This was an awesome interview. I'm really, really proud of it. And I think you guys are going to get a ton from this. So before we jump in, I just kindly ask, please do share this with one or two of your friends. We work super hard to find these incredibly successful founders and get them to share with you. Like, a lot of these founders don't really do podcasts, and we work really hard to get them to come on the show. So the only thing I ask is just share this with a friend. This is 100% free. It helps us really grow and fulfill our mission at Founder, which is to build a household name entrepreneurial brand impacting tens of millions of people every single week with our content. We will not stop to serve a lot of people at scale. So, yeah, guys, please do share this with a friend and please do leave us a review wherever you're listening. Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, it all helps. All right, guys, that's it from me. Now let's jump to the show. The first question I have for everyone that comes on is, how did you get your job?
The good thing about being an entrepreneur is you don't have to apply for much, right? You just have to be an idiot that tried to start something that everybody else thinks is idiotic at the time. So I guess I got the job because my co-founders and me kind of was hanging out and we wanted to build something nice with people we liked, and we stumbled over building cool stuff for dogs, and yeah, they haven't kicked me out since.
Yeah, wow. So when did Bark originally BarkBox, right?
Yeah, like originally BarkBox. Well, BarkBox is still around; it's still our biggest product line. Since then, we've kind of started to launch other products and services. And so now the holding company is Bark, but the product line, one of the big product lines, BarkBox. We have SuperChewer, we have Bark Bright, we have Bark Essentials, we have a number of other things. So yeah, we started, officially we started 2012, probably started to work on the project in 2011. And then we launched kind of like early in the year for 2012. So we've been up and running for, 8 years or so.
Yeah, wow. And you guys, like, you guys are very, very well known in the space. Like, is this your first business?
No. It's not my first business. I've been, I'm an old man. I started back in the very early days of the internet. Back then, this is way too old for you. Like, it used to be called FidoNet, and there was like the internet was you used. Services like Gopher and Veronica. And so I was lucky enough that I'm kind of like young enough to have had my careers using technology, but kind of old enough to have been one of the first that kind of started to use technology. And so I've been around the block for a little bit.
I see. So how did you come up with the idea for BarkBox?
I think counter to many other people, it wasn't that BarkBox was this big idea that we thought would be a billion-dollar business. I think it was, Matt and I, who started working on it a few months before Carly joined us, had built businesses before and kind of had raised venture capital. And I think at the time, we were a little bit kind of just wanted to build something that would be a little small kind of hustle that we didn't have to raise capital. So Matt and I met, and this is a true story, in a heart-shaped bed on a cruise ship, because we were on this conference, and if you took the cheap ticket, you would be automatically matched with somebody else, like just to share like the room. And they, obviously because you didn't know people, they kind of pushed the bed apart. But I thought it'd be hilarious to put these beds back together. So I was checked into the room first, put the beds together, went out for some drinks, and Matt then came in after, went to bed before me. And so the first time I ever meet my co-founder, I'm meeting this strange man that I never met before, lying in this hardship bed in a cruise ship. So we then started to brainstorm about building businesses, and Matt had built this business called meetup.com, which is a pretty famous business over here in the US. And is this fascinating man. And pretty quickly we realized that we shared a lot of the same values when it came to business building. We were just kind of shooting the shit and kind of thought it would be fun to do something with dogs, because I was adopting dogs at the time, and Matt was kind of like have this Great Dane called Hugo. And so, the idea was kind of like, hey, let's do something with dogs. Couldn't we put like a box together with some cool things? And it wasn't kind of too thought through an idea. And then I built the first version over a weekend, and then we started to show it to friends, and they were like, oh, that's awesome. I'll sign up when you're ready. And we were, we have Square on our phone. We could just take your money right now. And so I think the first 70 account was kind of like us just swiping credit cards on our phones without us having anything else than just a WordPress site that didn't really work.
Yeah. Wow. Interesting. And then how did you guys meet Kylie?
So Kylie Matt and I were both entrepreneurs in residence at these venture funds. And Matt was running a kind of an incubation space called Dog Patch Labs here in New York City. That was a venture firm called Polaris. I think that were financing that people could come and sit there for some months. And Matt was kind of running that. I was running something called Prehype, and he and Carly was kind of like knew a lot of the people that was kind of, in that space. I think she was playing soccer with them. And so after found out that was 70 people who wanted our product, we were like, hey, now we actually have to do it. That sounds like a lot of work. And Carly is this force of nature, and she had just started Uber in New York. So she was, I think, the first hire in Uber setting up the New York operations. And she wanted to kind of start her own business. And so, we lured her to hang with us. And so that's how we met her.
Yeah. Wow. Interesting. And, you know, you guys are one of like best known for as being like one of the fastest, you know, American growing pet companies. Like, so what do you think has caused that? Was that luck? Was it always like that after the first 70, or was it just
pure brilliance? Just a rocket ship? Pure brilliance. It's pure brilliance. No, I think you're right. I think there's a lot of luck. And I think it was luck, not just because timing was right, but a lot of things happened that kind of panned out well for us. The pet industry at the time had not really seen a lot of innovation. People were not really taking it serious. There was a startup in the first kind of dot-com wave. I think it was called pets.com. That raised a lot of money, got a lot of flat, like, and then closed down. And so I think it was considered one of those kind of industries that people didn't really want to touch. And so I think first we came into an industry that hadn't seen any innovation for a long time. There was hardly any startups in the space, but it's a humongous industry. Like every third household have a dog. And so there's this very big industry and not a lot of players in it. And so we kind of stumbled into that. I think secondly, we came in at a time where the people's relationship to their dogs were changing. And so dogs were no longer pets living kind of out in the yard. They were kind of invited in and becoming part of the family. And maybe because I have a background from MTV, where I used to run product development, we kind of took very much like a lifestyle approach to dog ownership pretty early. And so we started creating a lot of content. And kind of, I think, tapped into, you know, a culture that was already there, but really didn't have a place to hang out, which were everybody like me and Matt and Carly who see dogs as their kids. And I think, you know, then we were good of attracting a lot of quirky people that understood how to kind of use the internet as a tool for customer acquisition. And so I think the technology was right. The timing was right. You know, our approach was right. And I think all that with a ton of luck just made us kind of becoming what we always try to do is hopefully like a player in becoming kind of that defining brand for dogs.
Yeah, I see. And like, did you guys end up raising VC?
We failed and are not trying to raise money. So we have raised money. I can't remember the exact number. It's kind of like in the $50 million range. And we've done that over the last 8 years. I think, though, what have always happened is that we've always been a pretty frugal company. Matt and I have in our past raised a lot of capital for our companies. And I think learned that raising money doesn't necessarily mean that you're successful. And so I think one of the things which, you know, we're very fortunate about now is that we're a profitable company. And that obviously in a time where like times are getting tougher, like is a nice place to be because you can decide your own destiny. And so we haven't raised capital for, I want to say 4 years or something like that. Yeah, I guess we're a little bit like of an old school conservative company when it comes to burning money.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. So you would say you've gone full circle, and if you had a choice for your next company, if you did, you know, launch another company, you would raise VC or you would not?
I mean, like, I'm not big on blanket statements. I think founders need to find the company that fit them. And sometimes that is a bootstrap company. And I think sometimes that's a venture-backed company. And I think both are fine. There is, of course, the realization that you learn when you've done a few companies is that the second that you take venture capital, you put yourself on the track of making a very specific type of company. And that is, you know, a high growth kind of a little bit of winner takes all kind of like position. And so I always think that companies should just find out how they make a real solid business. The way that I kind of operate is I like to understand real pure unit economics. And I think if you then have a way of growing that much faster by getting capital, then you should go out and get it. But I'm also like the type of businesses I'm have been involved with and Bark, like it's a very, I would say, like traditional business where we build a direct to consumer brand. Obviously, if you build a technology company or other forms of companies, then venture is probably the way to go. So I don't know. It's not a very sophisticated answer. I think you should be mindful about not taking capital if you don't know why you're taking it. And I don't think that raising capital in itself should ever be a success metric.
Yeah, that makes sense. Talk to me around kind of these times, because you made an interesting point that fortunately you guys are profitable and you're being, you know, you have the opportunity to be like a more older school business and be a bit more conservative. You know, I'd love to hear your take and comment on these particular times. Have you guys been affected? What are you doing to tackle this?
I mean, like, these are obviously very scary times for a lot of companies, and I think us too. There is every day there is a new big risk that could suddenly make your company kind of like be in real trouble. And so we're definitely mindful of that and are constantly kind of looking at everything from supply chain to weakening in the market to, you know, all these different things like banks, you know, like suddenly kind of like changing terms. I don't think that we are out of the weeds. We have the advantage right now that the pet industry historically is a recession-proof industry. And at this point, it looks like people still is looking to get our product, and we sell it primarily online. So I think we are in a decent shape right now, but it's definitely scary times for everybody.
Mm. From your experience, because you've built companies, previous to Bark, and sounds like you're pretty, I could say a bit of a, you know, you've got that experience. Would there be anything that you would be thinking about or would like to share with our audience around how they should be thinking about things at a time like this? Like, what kind of mindset do you have as a founder right now?
Well, the good thing about being a founder is that you're nervous all the time. So you don't necessarily you're kind of used to being in a situation where everything is uncertain and where you have high level anxiety. So I guess like we have a little bit of a head start on that. Like some industries are just completely hit, right? If you're entertainment or you're in, you know, businesses like hospitality, there is not a lot you can do because people, for obvious reasons, kind of will not be able to use your product. And it's very tough. And you will probably have to go through what a lot of founders have gone through as part of their career, and that is letting people go or basically just realizing that the thing that you had dreamt about becoming very big won't be. And I think that is a very traumatic experience for everybody. And you also will have a lot of staff that is very concerned about their jobs and things like that. And so I don't think necessarily there is like a universal piece of advice. I mean, like, I feel that if you have strong integrity and you're honest for your staff and you try to be optimistic, but you're, you know, telling people as it is, I think if nothing else, they will respect you for that. And so I think that's the only thing. I will say, though, that as a founder, a lot of people look at how you conduct yourself. And so it's important not to lose yourself. And so I would give the advice that I think I give advice to entrepreneurs at all times. And that is making sure that you stay in a good headspace, make sure you get to work out a bit, make sure that, you know, install that Headspace app or whatever you're using to kind of make sure that you don't kind of go crazy yourself, because a lot of people's kind of jobs and mood is greatly affected by how you conduct yourself on Zoom or on video conference every day. But I don't know. I don't think necessarily I have a magic wand that or a piece of advice that is super helpful in these times.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough. Because I'm always really interested in mindset. Like, one time I met somebody and they said to me, you know, if you want to build a $100 million company, let's just say hypothetically, let's just say you want to build a $20 million company. If it's already done in your mind, like and you believe that you can do it, you're 50% of the way there. Do you agree with that statement?
You know what? I think there's different ways that people think about this. I think my co-founders, they are very goals orientated. Like they see something and they go for it. And I think that is very helpful. And I think for a lot of people, that is a very good way of having your mental model. I think for me, it's a little bit different. I'm more of a like I call like means or environment orientated person. I kind of like try to make sure that I'm good headspace. I try to work with the smartest people I can gather around me. And I kind of like, but I don't necessarily know where, what then will come out of it. And so it's a little bit of like, if you make sure that you have all the different components, all the ingredients are fine, then something's good is going to, like be created at the end of the day. But I'm not in the same way as other people are where I say like, I want to build a $100 million company or I want to hang with people that are kind and smart and quirky and I want to build cool shit that the world needs. And then I hope I make a lot of money doing it. But I kind of like it's not the other way around. And I think ironically for me, it wasn't really until I started to think that way that I started to make stuff that actually worked. Before, when I was just chasing cash, it was always I always ended up kind of building stuff that was too late or, like just didn't work because I was changing the cash instead of chasing understanding a problem that the customer had and finding a good solution for it.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting take. So when it comes to mindset, the things that you're doing is mainly kind of things around just like meditation, working out, and just
it's not like I'm a chubby Danish boy, so I'm not sure necessarily like I it makes it sound like I'm all fit. I do think that I'm 44 now. I've been building companies most of my career, and so I guess I've done it a few times, and I've definitely learned that you can work yourself to death and not necessarily become successful. And so I'm probably taking more the stand of like make sure if you choose to be an entrepreneur, you are statistically likely to fail. It's going to be hard work. And so make sure that you go through that journey with people you like and make sure you build something that you can be bothered thinking about every day. Because that almost like the byproduct of being an entrepreneur is kind of like the value like that everybody is jealous of. Yes, they're also jealous when you're successful and you make the money or envious or impressed. But it is like choosing who you can work with, choosing who you work with, choosing at what hours you work that a lot of people would like to emulate. And so make sure that you do that.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And you said something that was interesting to me around kind of surrounding yourself with like really nice people, good people, kind people, and some of the smartest people. That makes sense, but how does that work in practice, right? Like, what do you do to do that? Like when you say let's just say you said in the early days of Bark, you met some really, you brought on some really quirky, cool people. Like, is there anything there on like the hiring front that you could share from your experience when it comes to finding really, really smart, great people?
I mean, I think different companies have different DNA, and I have definitely seen very, very successful company that are very aggressive, are filled with like just killer types, and that is great for them. And there are businesses out there that, like a very, very large business is building culture like that. That is just not how I am, and so I wouldn't thrive in that specific culture. And so the type of organizations that I try to be part of or try to make are one that's a little bit more mirrored over the types of environment that I prefer to be in and the one that I kind of enjoy. So I will say that I probably emphasize gelling and connecting with people that I work with a lot, specifically in the early days, because I know that when you build an organization, the DNA that you set in a company in the first, let's say, 20, 30 hires is very often the culture that you'll see when you are then 300, because people hire people who have the same values as themselves. And so I have the joke internally that I'd rather hire somebody that I like than somebody who is competent, which is obviously a joke. But like but there is a little bit of like the meaning to, you will have to call people on the weekends and you'll have to have very difficult conversation with people. And so you might as well choose people where you think that conversation is going to be not as difficult if it's somebody that you don't have a good rapport with. And I think the quirkiness is maybe just because Matt, Carly, and I are quirky people ourselves. And so that was but also like we work about making dogs happy, right? Like it's not a very killer industry, right? It's about having empathy and loving animals and really kind of like being the people that the dogs think we are, which seem to be like superhumans that we're not really, but like at least my dog always think that I'm awesome, and so I'd like to be that person.
Yeah, that's cool. I'm curious, someone asked me this question the other day, and I'd love to hear your take around kind of like with your team, and like, are you really good friends with like people in your team, or how do you maintain that kind of, do you want to maintain that like, you know, there is a difference in kind of hierarchy or anything like that? Like, what's your take there? Like, do you want to be the boss, or do you want to ever be perceived as the boss? Or yeah, you know,
I don't think so. Like but again, I think it's just up to the individual. I think Matt, Carly, and I always really enjoy that people treat us like the interns, right? Like, and that, you know, there's no need to have like specific kind of like respect because that we were the first one through the doors. We try to kind of like be very approachable and not create that leveling. And so to answer a few of your questions, like we definitely try not to create any type of specific kind of allure around us. And maybe it's because of our own insecurities, but I think it has allowed us to have a lot of very smart, very talented people around us because very autonomous people around us because they really do what they think is best for the business. Now, obviously when a company grows so that's to like how people see us. I think to how working with friends, I think in the early days, obviously we were very close to people because we were sitting and working together all the time. I think as you kind of mature and you grow as your company, the type of people who come into your organization and the type of relationship that you need to have with people is going to change in nature. Yes, you are friendly, but you're not necessarily – like I think I always see people as my friends, but I also realize that I have a dual role. I am both somebody that I hope that they feel that they can trust, but I'm also somebody who have like different decision making in their career and if they have a job or not and stuff like that. And I think I learned as I got older that you have to honor that. You can't be the one who's there at the end of the holiday party because people are drunk and they'll say stuff to you that they will regret at the end of the next day. And it is on you to make sure that you don't put them in that situation. And so I do think that, yes, you can be friendly, but you also have to realize that often you are people's boss and that is your responsibility to make sure that that is honored. And I would say like the third thing is that I think as you then get bigger, then people start to, they don't know you that well. And so they're like more folklore kind of comes into place where people see, oh, you know, this is the CEO or there's the founder. And then suddenly I think you're seen as more of a thing that you might even think yourself, but just because the people don't know that you're just making the shit up as you go along, they think that you know more or are smarter than you are, and therefore they prescribe kind of like more authority to that, I think.
Yeah, no, that's funny how you said like around making shit up as you go along. Like you've you've had incredible success as a company and as a leader, but you've still been making shit up as you go along, and that's the case for everyone, right? Nobody really knows what they're doing. They just pretend, yeah?
Oh, yeah, and like obviously when you've done it a few times, you have experience at least what not to do, but no, I think you're right. Like, I was fortunate. I was pretty young, and I became head of product development for MTV International, and I was in my 20s. And I remember once sitting at this meeting with a bunch of CTOs for big companies that was big at the time, like Ericsson. And like these were like big, compact, and like these were companies that were very large at the time. And I was sitting there with people who are much older than me. And I was like, oh, no, I hope they don't realize that I don't know shit and I'm making all this stuff up. And then suddenly I looked around and was like, hey, wait a minute. They're all just making all this stuff up. They don't know anything about this stuff. And I think that's always kind of like stayed with me. And I think now, obviously, I'm more secure and I feel more certain in some of the decisions that I make because I've tried more things. But sometimes I feel that people assume that you've thought much more about stuff and you've definitely thought about it. But a lot of times you are just taking decisions based on your experience and you don't know if it's the right or the wrong thing. And you just hope that you're right.
Yeah, 100%. And that kind of brings me to like another thing that I've learned across speaking to many different founders is the reflection of where you are right now is a reflection of the decisions you've made thus far to get there. And you don't have to be right 100% of the time, but would you say you have to be right like 60, 70% of the time?
You know, I think often these things are not that binary. You make decisions and they kind of like gives you new options. And those options can kind of be better or less good. And so, I mean, like I was fortunate enough with Matt and Carly that they know a lot about things that I don't know much about. And without them, you know, like I sit a lot on the creative side of the business and I feel pretty comfortable about a lot of the decisions I make there. A lot of the decisions that I made in their fields, I have no idea. And I just trust that they make great decisions. As per kind of like brand building and product development and stuff like that, I think I feel pretty confident in a lot of the methodology that I've developed over time. And I feel pretty comfortable about being vulnerable about the decisions where I don't have enough information or knowledge or experience to make a clear call. And there I feel that now we have a good team where we can talk it out and saying, I don't know if this will work, but you know, here's the components of it that I think seem to be working. Here's like the area that I'm not sure about, and so what do people around the room think? And so I feel like vulnerability doesn't have to be weakness, and if you're comfortable enough in your own skin and your own decision making to be vulnerable when you have something that you're not certain about, I find often in dialogue with your colleagues you can get to a pretty good decision.
Yeah, it's kind of being self-aware and in tune and being like, yeah, just kind of trusting your gut as well. Yeah
and at one point, you just have to make a decision. Sometimes, like taking a bad decision. I used to make this joke. I at MTV, I ran a lot of creative directors, and I didn't. I don't have a design background. And now, like through my last 20 years career, I often sit in a role where I have to make final calls on designs. And so I used to make the joke about consistency of saying it doesn't really matter that you designer X, you know, has better taste than I have. You know, it's consistency is more important than taste. And at least I have consistently bad taste. And so if we just always follow my taste, then it'll be consistent. But I think there's some truth to that. Like if you look at brands, for example, that I think are strong, it is because that customers understand what they will get when they interface with them. And that is all about consistency. And then even something that doesn't look visually as stunning, if it's consistently that way, then I think people feel comfortable about it.
Mm. So when you talk about branding and, you know, the Bark brand, you guys have done very, very well. What are some key elements there which you think have built that brand that you've strategically kind of finessed into the consistently over time in the past, you know, 8 years plus?
I think we always had taken a stand of what we call the inside out brand. And what I mean by that is that we have some pretty, we only hire people who love dogs a lot. And we always have very good intentions. And so I feel what have happened, and we've always given a lot of our staff pretty big authority to do whatever they wanted to do with the brand. And so in many ways, the brand is this kind of cook up that we've done together as a group. And I think a few things have happened because that we developed it kind of collectively. We always kind of like seemed very authentic when we were talking to people, because when you call our customer service team, you're talking to somebody who probably sits with a dog on their lap. And when you read one of our Facebook comments, you meet somebody who is there because they love dogs. And so I always felt that authenticity that we've had on our mission of making dogs happy was kind of like very pure all the way through. Now, sometimes that means because that we just always let everybody kind of like in the last mile have a lot of authority in what they could do. Sometimes it's not that pretty. Like sometimes I'll see a logo being done in a bad way, or sometimes somebody will do something on social and I'm like, that's probably a little bit outside what I had hoped we would do. But because that it all come, I think, from good intentions, like we've always kind of gotten away with it. And so I think just being very approachable and just really being very respectful of the core problem that we're trying to solve and being very kind of like aligned with our customers and that we're all here just to make dogs happy, I think have allowed us to talk to them in kind of like eye level, where I think a lot of other brands kind of like talk down to them, or they shout at them, or they keep themselves very glossy and beautiful, even though on the inside they're not. And so I think we've always taken a little bit of what you see is what you get.
Yeah. Level of humbleness.
Yeah. I think, you know, we serve our customers, you know, like we have a team called the Happy Team. So we talk to about a third of our customers every month.
Yeah.
Wow. And we obsess about having a chat with them. And the team that talks to them is called the Happy Team. And the Happy Team is led by this guy called Hanan. And he always talks about hiring people who have a servant's heart. And now I'm from Denmark, which is like a very equal society. And so the whole terminology of a servant is not something we have. We don't have servants in Denmark. You go into a restaurant, like the bartender will give you a little bit of like, you know, don't try and think that you're anything bigger than me, because like we're the same. Like it's a very, very leveled society. And so like when he started to talk about hiring people who had a servant's mentality, I was like, you know, it took me a long time to really compute, right? And I think what he had managed to do is really attract a lot of people who truly get very happy by seeing other people get happy. Like they just really would like to help. Like hospitality is embedded into their DNA. And that's why one of the reasons why our Happy Team sits in Columbus, Ohio, which is in the Midwest here in the US, where you just have a culture of being very kind and nice and humble. You know, where in New York, we're a little bit more like, hey, you know, what's your problem? Like, and so I think the Happy Team have really taught the rest of us a lot about like, how do you just make sure that you are very respectful and it is something to be very proud of if you can serve your customers well.
Yeah. Wow. So if you speak to a third of your customers every month, like how many, like in terms of scale, how many is that? Like that, how many, like that's big numbers.
Yeah.
Right?
I think we probably have 200-ish people sitting in Columbus, Ohio. Wow. With a dog on their lap and texting frantically pictures back and forth for our customers. And like we're happy to talk to them about anything. Like we will be sending them texts like, does your dog sleep on its back, on its paws? And, you know, when people's friends get too tired of getting pictures of their dogs, like we're always there to kind of like have a good chat about that. And so, but in many ways, like that business, that part of our business is not a customer service team only. Like it's our research team. It's the people who can tell us what products we should build next, because people tell them what products they should build. Like, and when we do something dumb, you know, these are the ones who have a relationship and saying, hey, we're sorry, we sent you the wrong toy. Like, that's on us. Let us send you a new one. And so we feel that like the happy team is really the heart of our organization, and it's the one that informs a lot of the decisions that we make.
Yeah, that's really, really smart. That's a genius initiative because, yeah, sometimes I feel within even my own company that it's good even for me to get in on, you know, like the help desk and answer tickets, answer questions, see what's going on. And I always find it so fascinating, and it made me realize, yeah, we need to get this, like any of this customer service, speaking to our customers, supporting our customers, we need to get that through to our product and our marketing team because it's so key. Like the fact that you guys speak to a third of your customers, and I assume you have in the millions, maybe even tens of millions subscribers, like what kind of scale are we talking? What can you share?
I mean, like we have shy of like, I think we probably ship 2 million boxes by now. Like, so we have, you know, under a million subscribers, but like close to a million. I don't know the exact number, otherwise I would share it with you. But let's say like it's shy of a million subscribers. And so, yeah, we would talk to 300,000 customers a month. And I think you're totally right. Like there's this irony that we talk about trend analysis and forecasting and product development and roadmaps. At the end of the day, our job is to understand what are the problems we can solve for our customers. And very often, they'll just tell us, right? And so we don't have to kind of be that academic about it. We just have to ask them. And if I look at some of the most successful product lines that we created, for example, we have a business line called Superchewer, which is like more active for more active dogs, like more durable toys, like rubber-based toys. And, you know, it wasn't too difficult to come up with when suddenly your customer call and saying, hey, all these plush toys that you send me, my dog chewed them up in like 30 seconds. And we're like, hey, wait a minute, maybe we should make some toys that they don't chew up in 30 seconds. And then we send them, you know, some toys and we say, hey, would you kindly tell us what you think about them? And they say, this one is good and this is bad. And by now, I think we ship like 100 million products and we have net promoter scores on all of them. And so if you then take that kind of like empathy and you mix that with an obsession of data collection, suddenly you know what a six-year-old Labrador in Texas really like because you just have been through enough of these conversations to give you a pretty good statistical kind of prediction of what this dog would like. And then obviously we can use that intelligence to go back and saying, hey, you have this at this dog. We think that they really might like this product.
Yeah, that's genius. So you guys obviously started as BarkBox, but then you've kind of opened up, made Bark the parent brand, and you've bolted on other product lines to service this customer base, but then also have a more wide range offering to bring in other people that might not be interested in BarkBox as an example. That's a very smart strategic move and it's a way to grow, but focus is key. And how do you know when to move into the next product line or just keep crushing and, you know, like doing really well on the one?
Yeah, you know what? Like this is where I might be a little bit contrarian on that. I actually on Tuesday I have a book coming out called The Acorn Method about this specific topic. And that is because I think philosophically we have for 50 years heard focus is key. I think the reality is, and so what I did was I was looking at some of these companies that was very successful, you know, the Apple of the world or the Amazon or even companies like ourselves. And what I think I noticed was like trees, at one point when a product line matures, it just can't grow any further. And so the way that trees have learned to develop over the years is not to become a much bigger tree, but to become a forest. And so if you take Apple, for example, they used to be a desktop company, then they became a music player, then they became a phone company, and now they're product like a services and entertainment company, or trying to be that. And so I think my view is that, yes, you should be very brutal about the discipline about not kind of like starting to do everything, but you should experiment a lot. And when you experiment, you find exponential ways of growing or of offering a better service. And then you should keep doing that, but you should keep experimenting. And so I think where I would counter a little bit what you said is that I'm on the business building belief that you should grow your your service onto a specific maturity. But then, like trees, you should think about, how do I regenerate myself? What is my system for keep kind of like be growing? And sometimes that is not just growing, you know, further up. That is about growing wide. And so that's the business strategy that we've had.
Interesting. And what compelled you to write the Acorn Method?
I think, you know, I've had like, I have two organizations that I'm involved in. Obviously, Bark, which is the one that I, you know, spend the last 8 years on. But I'm also part of an organization called Prehype, which is kind of a collective of entrepreneurs. And they teach through that organization. I teach at business schools and I advise kind of large companies on how do you become more entrepreneurial. And I think what I noticed was that over the last 10 years or so, companies are trying to grow and they're spending a lot of money doing it, but they don't seem to be very successful. In fact, most of the Fortune 500 companies are staying in the Fortune 500 index for shorter and shorter period of time. And so there's this kind of like fascinating kind of things happening where corporate innovation spend 10x what venture capital does, but the companies are growing slower and slower. And so I kind of obsessed about trying to understand what was that. After having kind of like been on the advisor side for 10 years doing that, I was like, well, maybe I should take at least the ideas and the learnings that I've had there and then share them as kind of like the beginning of a conversation about how does companies keep growing, specifically in uncertain times where, you know, other startups will come in and try to compete against you, or technology companies will compete you, or something in the world kind of changes. So suddenly, like, the world is more uncertain. I feel that companies need to find ways of retaining that entrepreneurial and experimental muscle so they can keep growing.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. So you're all about going wider. We'll still go deep, but go wider when you can.
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm on making sure that the core works, like the core tree has to kind of like stay tall and be robust. But at one point, you are not going to get exponential growth of putting another branch on. You're going to get exponential growth about creating a system where you can plug an acorn or a bunch of acorns around fertile ground. And then you have to be very disciplined about not over-investing in any of them that is not basically growing straight up. Now, one of them might grow straight up so fast that at one point that tree will become bigger than the tree that kind of like incubated it, as it were. And that is fine because you would be owning that business line. And I think that is what Apple and Amazon and a lot of other companies have managed to do, retaining that entrepreneurial and experimental model so that they can keep eclipsing themselves by building new that became bigger than what they had originally.
Yeah, no, I think that's spot on. Now, I think about this as well, like even in our company, because, you know, we started off as a magazine and now we're kind of moving into not just magazines, but online education. And, you know, we've been doing that for a few years now. And now, you know, we're going to go deeper there. But when I think of vertical or going wider, you know, I'd love to build like a SaaS company or something, a series of tools that help founders. And I think that's really smart. It's just from my own experience, it's very, very difficult to know how to make sure you don't get distracted. And is it a shiny object versus, you know, sticking to the core, maintaining the core and all of that. And that's, it's such a fine balance from personal experience.
What a nice pluck for me to talk about the book. I think you're totally right. And I think that is why it's important and I think that is one of the big issues that companies have. How do you make sure that you don't suddenly take the focus from like the organization that are basically paying your bread and butter, paying for, and then kind of like moving over to the new shiny object? And so a few thoughts. You need to first, I think, be very good at figuring out what is basically your equivalent of the acorn. And I think what's important is that it's something that's standalone and it's something that is not part of your current organization. And so the way that we, because you're based in Australia, you know, one of the business lines we have that is growing very fast for us is is a business called, it's our home line. It's called the Essential Line. It's beds and pee-pads and poo-bags and stuff like that. And we're selling them primarily on Amazon. And so Whitney, who runs that, used to be an entrepreneur. She built a business, didn't have big success with that, and was kind of like looking, trying to figure out what to do next. And so we asked her to basically figure out what she would do with Amazon. Now, we kind of like put her on the side. We said, basically, you can't use any of the tech resources you have. You're basically on your own. But if you have specific thing you need from us, you can come and ask for it, and we'll make sure they clean that. And so Kali kind of like and her went off to the side and built this like double digit million dollar business line like in 12 to 18 months just by kind of like using a lot of the assets, but not interfacing at all with our core organization. And so like an acorn, we kind of dropped it in a place where we thought there was fertile ground, which for us was about building essential products for dogs and selling them on Amazon. And we definitely then had like, if you like, a root system so that there was like connecting tissue, but we gave it a lot of autonomy and a lot of independence so that it didn't kind of go in and remove the focus. And we basically said to everybody, you can't deal with Whitney. Basically, she is in control. She calls the shot, you know, tech team, legal team, brand team, all these other team, like this is like off limit for you. Now, we've done that before where it didn't work. We launched a vet on wheels business. And so we constantly look at building these new business lines. And the way that we look at it is we take an autonomous team, we put it somewhere we think there's fertile ground, we give them a certain amount of resources. And if they run out of those resources, basically they're default dead. And so it's not where we just keep throwing money at it because like, you know, oh, we just give them a little bit more. Like if they're out of money, they're out of money. And so I think in the same way as the acorn, which also comes with a little bit of fertilizer and a little bit of DNA from the mother tree, you know, and some very strict rules about growing straight and up, then we have tried to kind of like emulate a model where we can get those two, both those two worlds. We can get the entrepreneurial fast grow, but we can also kind of like make sure that they don't interface with the mothership.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. That's really cool to hear. Do you have to, as a leader though, like, or even just Kylie, Matt, and yourself, make sure you guys don't get too kind of interested and moving towards this new shiny thing, because where your guys' attention flows, naturally your team, if what you guys are most excited about, naturally your team will be most excited about, and all that side of things. Like, how do you manage that? You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. Well, I think it's all about being disciplined about it. I think you're totally right. Like that does tend to happen. We have the luxury that we are three people so that we can kind of divide and conquer a little bit. And Matt has with that case, we're much more kind of like involved in the core and making sure that like we grew that organization into something that was very mature. And then we have really smart people who kind of could help kind of making sure that we create kind of systems and scaffolding for the core thing. And so we don't have to sit there and work on it every day. We can invent systems that other people can take over. But I don't think there is, I think you're totally right. Like when we start to kind of get excited about it, then a lot of people want to be excited, and we just have to be very disciplined about saying, no, this person is working on it. They're the only person that's working on it. Nobody's invited. Nobody's on the email, to the point where like a lot of these teams, like Kali is doing this on another business line right now, and they have their own Slack. They have their own, like they're separate. Yeah, wow. Like they have their own email. They're, for all intended purposes, like completely on their own island. They have their own tech stack.
Shared services.
No, because like I think sometimes you have this idea that the shared services is going to be really nice for the synergy, but the reality is that it just makes you run slower. And also like the people who are responsible for making sure that the existing business that's working is working, you know, they have to be a little bit more conservative, and they have to be more about protecting that than necessarily trying to invent new, where the new has to invent new all the time, right? You know, and they might want to use like at Bark now, we're such a big company, like the systems that we have to just move all these products that we send out every month around, like it's like huge systems, and there's consultants coming in and making sure they talk to all the systems, and there are accountants coming in and doing like you know, like auditing and all this stuff. Meanwhile, we're trying to invent something new over here, right? And they have to have the flexibility to just do whatever they want to do, because I feel it's a bigger risk that you build something that the customer don't care about and that doesn't scale than it is that suddenly that we can't tie it into our system.
So I'll
give you an example. When we started BarkBox, everybody was asking me, how are you going to pack the boxes? And I always used to say, oh, we're going to pack them ourselves. And people go, oh, that won't scale. And I was like, I understand that might be a problem, but the reality is I have 70 boxes. It'll take me about a good 20 minutes to pack. And so it scaled just fine. Like when we have a million boxes, we will have a robot and a 3PL and systems in place. But at that time, we also have shitload of revenue. And so therefore, we can kind of afford throwing money at it. And so sometimes people, I think, obsess about like the scalability of something before figuring out what is the magic, what is the service, what is the product that the customers really love? If you can find that, then I feel often you can find a way of scaling that on the back of it.
Yeah, love it. So look, we have to work towards wrapping up, Henrik. This is a great conversation. Question around kind of this idea of, you focus on the core, you work out what your core is, then you look to bolt on other products and or services while maintaining the core. Like that's a good model. And I'm curious, every one of these new products that you guys, you know, new product lines that you guys launch, do you first always offer it to your existing customer base?
Sure. Like yes and no. We do what we call signal mining early on, which is basically, can we get more data about if our thesis is right. And that might be that we send 200 emails to existing customers saying, hey, we're thinking about launching these specific products. What do you think? And that will give us like more indication. Sometimes if it's something specific, like we might use external tools. So let's make, we have a business line. We have these poopbacks and they have funny words on them, like funny statements. So we have one, I think, called Poopaganda. And so it's like make logs, not war. Or we have like one with rap titles, like I love it when you call me Big Pooper. Now, I don't know which one of the 60 funny statements that my creative team made were the best one. And so we just buy Instagram ads and we see what people click on. And so sometimes we do stuff like that. Now, the power, of course, of what we built at Bark now is that we are one of the only brands. We are the only brand in dog that touch in food, that touch in play, that touch in health, that touch in home, and so we have brand permission now to play on like the whole gamut, and that allows us to, when we launch, for example, the Bark Bright, which is our new dental product, we can add it to our box and saying, hey, you probably don't brush the teeth of your dog. You know you should. You don't want to do that. So we built basically a super cool toothbrush that your dog can eat. And we built this. We found this amazing these enzymes through this bioengineering company that will basically break down all the bad things in your dog's mouth. You should just add that to your subscription and then kind of like buy that. But I think that's back to the earlier point about the brand. Like, you know, I mean, like some companies have brand permission to spread out. Like if I told you that Nike's making a new hotel, you probably would have an idea what that would be. But if I told you that Hilton is making a new shoe, you probably wouldn't know what that would be. And so some companies naturally are more have bigger range in what they're allowed to do.
Interesting. When you attack kind of attack's probably not the best word. When you test a new product line and you kind of go off and incubate an idea or a hypothesis, build the MVP and whatnot for you know, a lean startup methodology. One thing I know that Jeff Bezos is big on, I've done a little bit of it at Founder, is finding people that have come from other companies that have tackled that particular space. Like if you're going like a totally different vertical, but for a similar customer base, do you do that? Do you look for people that have that experience?
Yeah, I think we, again, are a little bit lucky because of our industry and nothing has been made there. And so we can often find people who've done something in a people space and try to attack in the same way. So a bunch of our toy designers have come from a background of making kids' toy, because that they understand how do you understand how play is, and then how do you create something that strengthens that kind of experience. So we definitely do some of that. But sometimes we take the posture that you have to invent something new. And there we just go for very entrepreneurial people. So people who are very good of being versatile. So they know design development, business development, people who have agitation. So just like they just have a chip on the shoulder. Like it's like they're constantly people who have great user empathy. So they kind of like naturally think about, like, I wonder what the customer would think about that. And so some of these entrepreneurial kind of attributes that you don't necessarily recruit because of your experience in a specific industry, but you recruit because people have that specific personality.
Yeah, no, I see. Okay, interesting. Well, look, really mindful of your time. We'll work towards wrapping up. Two last questions. One.
There's always three.
No, all right, we'll go with three.
There's always three things.
All right, we'll go with three. All right, you're getting greedy. Okay, where's the best place people can find out more about yourself and your work and your new book?
Yes, that is probably on Twitter. I'm at Werdlin, Werdlin. And so that's probably where I brag the most about things that I'm working on. But they can also just email me or tweet at me and whatever. I'm pretty open door policy.
Yep. And Acorn Method, when that coming out?
It's coming on, I don't know when this is going to be released. It's out on Tuesday the 28th. So this, we're recording this on a Thursday. It's coming out next Tuesday. Maybe by the time that you've removed all the dumb things I said on this podcast and edited out.
Okay. Awesome.
And it's, you can go just search the Acorn Method, theacornmethod.com, that there's a link to the book there.
Okay. Acornmethod.com. And then second question, advice on anyone going through the pandemic, experiencing their businesses, experiencing some sort of adversity, which we know probably majority would be. Advice there?
Get a dog. I mean, like, I don't know. Like, I think we all need to have people around us that we can talk to. And so I think just make sure you don't like get too isolated by yourself, but make sure you Zoom call your friends and talk to a few people, because I think you can go nuts if you just sit there and try to compute the whole thing in your head. But I do say, I think saying getting a dog does help, because at least you can talk to that.
Awesome.
And then give it a bark box, of course.
Love it. And then last one is, what's exciting for you? What in the future? What's most exciting?
You know, I am excited about the remote work that people start to do, and I think a resurgence. What I hope is going to be a resurgence of entrepreneurship. I think there is a lot of opportunity to build businesses and make money online. And I think this pandemic have taught us all that it's probably fine to work remote or to hire people who are remote. And so I think that makes it hard for a lot of people. But I think for people who probably listening to this podcast probably gives them an edge. And I think being an entrepreneurial person is probably one of the only skills which will transcend through all these different kind of like hot times and new technology developments that's going to happen. And so I think becoming better and better of looking at problems and finding systems to solve those problems in a scalable way, which I think is the core of entrepreneurship, I think is probably one of the best things that people can be spending their time on. And that's not just for making money, but that's also for solving the problems that we have in society and our communities and stuff like that. And so I'm excited for the people who probably are listening and reading your magazines and the content that you produce and the classes you guys do, because I do think that this entrepreneurship is like the skill of the future.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Awesome. Well, look, thank you so much for your time, Henrik. I won't take any more of it. You were very, very generous. It was a great conversation. And yeah, thank you so much. I hope you stay safe in New York, and I hope things get better soon.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me on.
Hey, guys, I hope you enjoyed this interview. As you might already know, our mission at Founder is to help tens of millions of people every single week with our content, either start or grow their business, which is exactly why we're partnering with world-class founders such as Damon John, Alexa Von Tobel, Greta Van Riel, and so many more to teach crucial skills such as negotiation, finance, e-commerce, and so much more. So if you'd like to get access to these free exclusive trainings, please go to founder.com/free. These are 100%. We go super in depth on teaching a particular topic, and I know that you're going to love them if you enjoy this podcast. So just go to founder.com/free. All right, guys, I'll see you in the next episode.